combined meeting of the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs with the Senate Committee on Rules. I'm Dan Doyle, chairing the House Committee, and with me is Senator Clarno as presiding co-chair for the Senate Committee. We have an information meeting today. It's a presentation relating to Oregon's initiative petition process for ballot measures and referenda. And I'd like to just go ahead and get started with John Lindbeck, Elections Director for the Secretary of State's Office. Mr. Lindbeck.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the members of both committees for the opportunity to talk to you jointly about this issue. We've worked on putting together a presentation for the legislature regarding the status of the Oregon initiative and referendum process. I think probably many of you followed some of the headlines last summer. We had more than our share of controversy and contentiousness with regards to this issue last summer, and I thought that it would be good before you folks got into the process of looking at individual bills for you to get a little higher view of the process, some perspective of what happened in the 2002 election cycle, because some things happened in 2002 that were very different. Example, just one. For the first time, we had observers insert themselves into the process. We had observers, when we got petition sheets in the Secretary of State's office and started sorting through them, we had almost as many observers watching over our shoulders as we had people doing the processing of the sheets. The counties, many of the counties had observers at the counties watching verification. And for the first time, it was a real eye-opener for us because the observers did succeed in exposing some systemic weaknesses, and I'll talk to a little bit to you about those later on in the presentation. And we hope to address those systemic weaknesses through some legislation this session. But it also, the other thing that was somewhat different about this election cycle in regards to the verification process is that the numbers were very close on several initiatives. We had initiatives make the ballot or fail to make the ballot by a whisker. And the impact of that on the initiative process was very similar to what happens when an election is very close in candidate races. Thus, you had the interest by observers on both sides of issues to get in there and sort of watch the process, try to determine for themselves whether or not they thought it was being conducted fairly, whether or not the right decisions were being made, and to try to influence the process. So I'll start sort of on a little higher level, though, because it's pretty clear when you look at some of the historical information that the initiative and referendum process is very, very important to Oregon. I'd like to talk to you about the history and impact of it, some of the basic procedures, the signature verification process, the problems that showed up in the 2002 cycle, and the proposed solutions. So that's the outline of my presentation for you this afternoon. So let's start with the overview. For those of you that aren't familiar with the history, the initiative process was passed in 1902 by a margin of 11-1. Oregon was the third state to adopt the process, and we placed our first statewide initiative on the ballot in 1904. And so I guess you could say that in 1904 the process here will be 100 years old. There have been 325 initiatives that have made the ballot. 67 referendums have reached the ballot. And Oregon, according to academicians that study such things, holds the record for the most statewide initiatives, the highest average initiative use, and the most statewide initiatives on a ballot in a single year. Obviously, it's very popular here. It's been used more frequently in other states. You know, California seems to get most of the publicity on this, but when you look at our numbers are higher than California almost all across the line. And here you can see the history of initiative use and how Oregon compares with the other states. We both have higher numbers both in the number on the ballot and the number adopted. The topics, of course, are addressed by a wide range of issues. There's environmental regulations, tax laws, criminal penalties, a variety of different kinds of things. The public has made active use of the process. Let's talk a bit about the basic procedure. A proponent files the initiative and referendum application with the Secretary of State, so they file an application with us. Copies of that are then sent to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General writes the ballot title and summary and then sends that back to us, the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State then sends those copies of the full text and the ballot title and the summary to the legislature, proponents, and any other interested parties. A comment period is opened for public review, and during the comment period, proponents can challenge the wording of the title and or summary with the Oregon Supreme Court. Our division. We compare the submitted cover and signature sheets to the approved versions. We review the signature sheets and sign circulator certificates, and we verify that each signature sheet is back-to-back with an approved cover sheet. The election staff then enters the data from each sheet, and a computer program counts the actual number of signatures submitted. So this is at the point when the petitions have been circulated and they all come into us. We have a computer program that randomly selects the first and second samples of signatures for verification. We do a sampling process. We do not do full signature verification in Oregon. And so the two samples together comprise 5.01% of the signatures that are submitted to us. Once we have gone through and identified those that the computer randomly selects, the signatures that are randomly selected, we go through and we actually highlight those on the sheets and we send the sheets to the counties. So it's a very manual process. And the counties receive the sheets and proceed with verification of those original signatures. They start out by looking at just 1% of the samples. And they verify the original signatures that are in that first sample, which is, as I said, 1%.
Yes. Question. 1% of the 5% or
1% of the total number of signatures submitted.
Okay.
The county then tracks and records any duplicate signatures that they find in that first sample. And then they complete a summary and verification results form, and they notify our division of the results of that first sample. Now, more often than not, initiatives do not make it on the first sample. It is possible to make it on the sample, and we did have a couple in this past process that did make it on the first sample, and it wasn't required for us to go to the second sample. But when we get those first samples back, the Secretary of State, then we process and tabulate the results, and we determine whether or not the initiative qualifies. If an initiative fails to qualify under just that 1%, then county officials are directed to complete the second sample, which has already been sent to them. That second sample is approximately 4% of the total signatures submitted, so that together they add up to 5. That process starts all over. The county elections officials go through all the signatures that we've highlighted for them. They verify whether or not that's a matching signature, whether or not that's a registered voter in their county. They track and record any duplicates that they find, and they complete the summary of verification results form, and they notify us of their results. We process and tabulate the results of the second and first samples together. We determine whether the initiative qualifies as a measure. We assign a measure number to those that qualify for the ballot, and we certify the state measure to county elections officials for placement on the official ballot. Now, before we get any further, I'm curious if any of you have any questions about the sampling process, because that has been a somewhat controversial topic for people that circulate or on either side of an initiative as it goes through the process.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Yes, I do have a question. Could you just go over for us the formula? For example, with duplicates, you subtract a certain number for signatures that are not registered voters in that county. You subtract a certain number. Could you just go over those,
right,
how you do that statistically?
The process, the statistical sampling process, was worked out under the consultation of a statistician, an expert at Oregon State University. His name is Dave Thomas, and he worked out this process for us to make sure that it was statistically valid. There is a 1 in 20 chance that you will be sampled. There's another 1 in 20 chance that you would be sampled twice. So you take 20 times 20, and under the statistical sampling process that he worked out, we subtract 400 signatures from their total of valid signatures for that petition
for
every duplicate. Now, if you have a voter who is not an eligible voter for some reason, let's say that they're on the inactive list and they're not eligible to vote in the election, and thus they are not eligible to sign petitions. That has been working out under the statistical process to a reduction of about 20 signatures in the overall sample for every example of that that you find.
Follow up. Are there any other categories? You got 20 if they're not registered voters, or I mean, all bad signatures are in that 20 category. There are no other categories. It's either 400 for duplicates,
right,
or 20 subtracted for,
right,
for whatever reason.
Approximately. It can vary a little bit depending on other,
okay,
other factors at work. But
and that would include people who might be registered voters but were listed on the wrong county form. The form was for the wrong county.
If you're not in the right county, that you would show up as being not registered on that list.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. By the way, just on the sampling process, we have had interest, I think, in litigation challenging our statistical sampling process by various parties through the years. We've generally been able to avoid that by having the person who's interested in suing, having their statistician talk to ours, and usually by some communication between the two statisticians and how it works, the threat of litigation over the sampling process has gone away, and so we haven't had a serious legal challenge to our statistical sampling process, even though there have been threats at various times. Okay, so here's the problem that cropped up in the 2002 cycle. We had some cases of fraud, and we appeared to have plenty of cases of sort of careless and slipshod signature gathering by people who are paid to gather signatures on the behalf of some of these initiatives. Let's talk a little bit about some of these signs of problems. We received numerous reports that folks that circulate petitions have encouraged folks to not worry about whether or not that they have already signed the petition. And of course, it's against the law to sign a petition more than once, and so they're clearly misleading the voters when they suggest that. We have had cases this past cycle where there was actual fraud and forgery. And the most sort of well-known cases happened in Portland at the Lloyd Center, in which two paid signature gatherers were taped. And taped in the process, videotaped in the process of performing some illegal acts. They have some interesting modes of operation out there, and let me just give you an example of how these two particular guys were operating, they used what they called a stopper petition in order to get folks interested in stopping at their table. This was not a real state initiative petition, by the way. The appeal here was something to do with gas taxes. Do you want to stop gas taxes? And, of course, that's a very appealing thing to a lot of folks. And they said, if you want to stop gas taxes, just sign our petition. And then people would sign the top form, and they would sign all the information on the top form. And then what they said was, okay, we have some other petitions here underneath this. Please sign your name, and don't worry about it. We'll fill in all the information on the other petitions. Just sign your name on these others. And insinuated that these other petitions were copies of the same petition when they were not. They were actually copies of real state initiative petitions. And so these folks went through and signed these other copies, and then these folks went back and filled in their information that was missing, and these folks that were the victims here were signing petitions that they didn't know that they had signed. They thought they were signing multiple copies of the same petition.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Can you explain what happened when Secretary of State's office was made aware of the fraudulent signatures?
When this was brought to our attention, we gathered as much evidence on it as we could, and we forwarded to the Attorney General's office for prosecution.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Were the signatures counted?
The signatures were never submitted to us, as far as we know. We sent a letter to various chief petitioners, in fact, to all the chief petitioners, and we said, there's a possible legal cloud over these signatures. We just want to warn you about that. If you submit them to us, it's possible that they could be challenged legally in some way, and no petitioners submitted signatures from these two individuals.
Follow up. Were there other suspect fraudulence or slipshod? I would tend to use the word fraudulent. Were there other examples of questionable signatures that were in fact counted by the Secretary of State's office because there was no mechanism not to count them?
Well, we had numerous complaints about other signature gatherers. None of the other cases were resolved in time, and in fact they're still working on all of those other cases. And so we didn't have any sort of conviction or anything to work with regards to any other cases. And so signatures were submitted by folks that had been complained about. And their signatures were processed and sent out to the counties, sampled and sent out to the counties, just like any other signature sheets were.
Mr. Chair, I just make this point that it appeared to me during that period of time that did the Secretary of State, I guess one more question, Mr. Chair. Did the Secretary of State's office in this session propose any legislation that would deal with the fact that you had no mechanism but to accept signatures that were under a cloud?
We have not submitted any legislation dealing with that specific issue here because Here's the problem with that. You get into the issue of whether or not, because there may be good signatures on some of those sheets. And so it comes down to the question, are you going to throw out the good signatures with the bad? And we do have a sampling process and a verification process that if there are forgeries, hopefully our verification process can expose those. And those signatures would not be counted.
Mr. Chair, I just find it hard to believe that Secretary of State's office can come up with bills to change the name of their corporate division, but they can't come up with some way to think in any large terms, since you're the experts on elections, to come up with a way to deal with these fraudulent signature gatherers. That was very upsetting at the time. I'm still concerned that that we haven't seen anything proactively from Secretary of State's office to help us with this problem.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it's not like we're not dealing with fraud. I don't think it's fair to say that we're not dealing with fraud. We're dealing with fraud in the way that you'd normally deal with fraud through the prosecution process. If the question here is, if somebody is has a complaint filed against them, if you're a signature gatherer and you have a complaint filed against you, does that automatically mean that every signature you're gathered for a petition should be thrown out? I would have problems with that, Senator Corcoran, because that means that somebody could file a complaint against every signature gatherer on the street and throw out every sheet. There has to be a way to deal with that problem, and there needs to be a presumption that there may be some good signatures on those sheets along with the bad. And do we want to throw out good signatures in order to deal with the bad ones?
Mr. Lindbeck, the issue of fraud, though, it's when you are actually, or some investigators are actually catching people, you know, doing the act you were discussing earlier, where they're enticing people to sign on sheets that they don't know they're signing or what the petition is, and that's a different action than having duplicate signatures or having invalid signatures. Is that correct?
Yes, very.
Go for presentation, please.
Okay. So, another to get back to where I was, we did have two notable cases of forgery that resulted in convictions before the deadline for submitting signatures. We have had cases where there are a lot of signatures on these sheets that are from ineligible voters. And we did get numerous reports that folks who are ineligible voters are sometimes encouraged or allowed to sign these petitions. We also had a problem with inaccurate voter name transcription. Under the current rules, all you have to do as a signer is sign your name. Someone else can fill in all the other information, or you can leave it blank. To the extent that you yourself leave it blank, you, of course, have a greater danger that of your signature not counting, because if your handwriting is at all messy and they can't read your handwriting, that other information is what allows the county officials to sort of go beyond the name and try to find you in your system if your handwriting is at all messy. What the current system allows is, because you're only required to sign your name, is for folks who engage in this business to hire what they call writers. And writers are paid to go in and take petitions from that example that I talked to you about, where people signed maybe just the top petition and then just added their names to the rest, and to take that information off one petition and fill it in on the others. The problem is that these writers didn't always do it correctly, and that's one of the problems that was exposed this year. And it's caused confusions and or mistakes at the county level in determining signature validity. I've got some examples later on that I can show you where that actually happened.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burke.
Thank you. Do the counties, when they're verifying the signatures, do they all check the actual signature so they can see if the signature is the same?
Yes, they check the signature on the sheet against the signature that is on your original voter registration card.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman, if the writer has made a mistake in the printed and the county clerk checks the signature is correct, but the information on the printed name or the address is wrong, what do they do with that signature? Is that valid?
Well, here's what happens. Let's all place ourselves in the shoes of a person who sits at a computer and is trying to verify these signatures. What happens is you'll take a look at these sheets, and I'll show you some examples later on, but you have a lot of messy handwriting there. particularly when it comes to signatures. And then you have a printed name. And so they'll look at the handwritten signature, and if it's at all unclear to them, then they move their eye moves over to that printed name, and that's the name they look for, because they can't really tell very clearly what the handwriting says. So they look at that signature as printed, and it doesn't pop up. You know, they'll input the name, and it doesn't pop up in their system. They can't find that person. And so it's coded by the county as not registered in our county. And what we found were some examples, and this is where observers, when they entered in the process or exposed this weakness, they went back and they said, well, that doesn't really say that. It says, you know, it doesn't say Linda Thomas. It says Lindsay Thomas, or, you know, vice versa. And they took a second look at that signature and indeed found that person. And so a signature that was initially coded as not registered turned out to be a valid signature. And so this is where the problem of the writers comes in, is that when they don't transcribe the name correctly, it caused some upheaval in the process. Let's go back to the duplication rate for a second. We only began tracking actual duplication rates in the 2000 cycle, and the signature duplication was previously incorporated into the validity estimations with an assumed constant rate. Now, the actual rate is turning out, at least in the last two election cycles, when we look at the actual rate of duplicates, is about 6% out of a total of 3,771,828 total signatures submitted. And the rate has appeared similar in the past two election cycles. And so people signing these petitions more than once is indeed a problem, and it is causing a problem for people in their ability to get their petition certified for the ballot. We also have had a problem with a lot of inactive voters signing petitions. And, of course, one of the problems is that people are walking around as an inactive voter, but they don't necessarily know they're inactive. And they've been moved to inactive status most of the time because they were sent a ballot and they had moved and their ballot was returned to the county. And under our law, that's sufficient evidence for a county to move a voter from active to inactive status. And a lot of people are out there walking around not realizing that they've been moved to inactive status because they, you know, election law isn't the top thing on their mind.
John, at what point can they return to active status? What's it take to be active?
They simply need to update their registration.
Can they do that even the day of the election?
Yes, right up through the day of the election. And what happens with a lot of people is they don't get their ballot for the next election, and they call the elections office to figure out why. And they said, well, we sent it to such and such an address. And they said, I don't live there anymore. And then you make them come down to the elections office, update their registration, and then they can vote. And that's enough to move them to active status. But the current state of the law is that in order to be qualified to sign an initiative petition, you have to be eligible to vote in that next election, or the election in which this would appear, at the time you sign the petition. And so if you are inactive, or were inactive on the date that you signed the petition, then you will be coded as an inactive voter, and that is not a good signature under our system.
Well, but John, if they can change to active status on the day of the election, how is it that they are considered to be ineligible to vote?
They have to be on active status on the date they signed the petition.
Mr. Chair? I believe we passed that in the 2001 session. Is that correct? It was a bill, was it not?
Yeah, let me confer with our legal counsel who may have that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Rossick. I'm general counsel to the Elections Division. The law that Mr. Lindbeck's talking about, ORS 247013, is not new. That wasn't passed in 2001. That has been the law all along. It In 2001, it was realized that some of the counties were allowing inactives to be considered valid signatures for purposes of signature verification for initiatives, and that was clarified in 2001, but the law hasn't changed. It's just been made consistent in interpretation.
Okay. Proceed.
Okay. So voters considered inactive if the county clerk has received evidence that there's been a change in the information that they need that's required for registration, and they have neither voted nor updated their registration for a period of not less than 5 years. That 247.013 is the statute that requires inactive voters update their registration before voting. The actual inactive voter signature rate is pretty high. We had about 3% of our signatures submitted in the 2000 to 2000 cycle that were actually inactive voters. And that's what showed up on the sample. And the rate jumped. As you can see on the illustration there, the mean average number in 2000 was 2.20%, and 2002 was 4.61%. So this appears, at least just looking at those 2 years, like it's a problem that could be getting worse, not better.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burke.
Can you go back to that one? They're considered inactive if either of those bullets are satisfied. In other words, if either the county clerk has received evidence or the elector has neither voted nor updated registration. Is that correct?
That's correct.
They don't have to both.
Right.
Thank you.
Next. Okay, and here's the examples of what I was talking about where we have this problem with writers. Take a look at Linda M. Thomas on line number 16 there. Pretty messy handwriting. The writer got in there and wrote it, and it says Lindsay Thomas. Lindsay Thomas was initially coded as not registered in that particular county. The observers started combing through these things and went, take another look at that signature. We think it's Linda M. Thomas. And the county agreed and changed their coding, changed their report to us.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As somebody that's circulated petitions, volunteer, as I have, and I'm sure many of us have here, and tell me if I'm wrong, all that's required is that there's signatures on there. Many times they skip writing it. So the person that has to sign at the bottom of the page that you witnessed all these, sometimes you go back and you try to write in those names. Is that illegal to do that? I mean, that's just something the circulator does trying to make it accurate.
Right. It's not illegal to do it. In fact, it's allowed. And as I mentioned earlier, the big operations that deal in signature gathering hire writers, quote-unquote writers, to do that. But we're seeing a problem with inaccurate transcriptions. We think that it's a problem that needs to be addressed, and we do have legislation that that does try to get at that problem.
Thank you.
Here's another example. Take a look at line 18. John R. McLean, M-C-L-E-A-N. When you take a look over at the handwritten or printed signature, on the right, it's John R. McLean, M-C-C-L-E-A-N. Caused the same kind of problem. And a third example, Sharon K. Herman Ingram on line 7 was written as Sharon Ingram, and because they left the Herman off, it caused a problem in terms of actually verifying that signature. As I mentioned earlier, we had two forgery convictions. We do believe more convictions are likely. We did take a look at the validity rates for 2002. We had 1,260,494 total signatures that were submitted. About 31% of those were declared invalid through our sampling process. You can take a look at this list of the various petitions, and the validity rates. And you can see that they vary quite a bit in this column right here. We had a high validity rate. Our highest validity rate was in
petition signature collection.
Yes, petition signature collection payments at 73.43%. On this particular petition, as I understand it, they did not pay gatherers by the signature. They paid gatherers by the hour. And it is interesting to note that their validity rate did turn out higher than on the other petitions.
Mr. Chair, the second highest was minimum wage. I just thought I'd point that out.
Because then none of the rest of us can see it.
Are we ready to move on? The problem of declining validity rates appears to be growing. We've had a steady decline since 1992. We had a validity rate of 85.38% in 92, 68.79% in 2002. It's just a little look at that statistic on how it's going. The validity rate is declining there. The invalidity rate, of course, is increasing on the other side of it. I'd like to talk to you now for a few minutes just about the systemic weaknesses.
Before you move on that, on the validity rates, is it anything to do with your own office, I think, being more cognizant of this issue and compare the way it was 10 years ago? Or is it just...
I don't think so, because the issues really came up in this election cycle, you know, and I don't know of anything that our division did in particular this election cycle that would have had a large impact on the validity rate itself. I mean, we go through and I'm sorry?
The people that were looking over your shoulder, didn't that have something to do with it?
Well, they were looking over our shoulder during the process. We get these sheets in and just big boxes, and we have to go through and we have to sort them all, and we have to make sure they're all sorted by county. We have to make sure that they're all numbered correctly. We have to make sure that there's a law that says that they have each sheet has to be attested to at the bottom by the circulator, that the correct information has to be on the one side of the sheet, the information about the petition itself that the voters are supposed to be able to read if they want to, and that has to be on the back of the sheet where the signatures are. So we go through and we follow that process, and what the observers in our office were trying to determine was whether or not we were accepting sheets that didn't basically what they were trying to make sure is that we were not letting sheets slip through that didn't follow the law. And the actual verifying of signatures is one step down in the process, and the observers went out to the counties to observe that as well. But the observers may have had a small impact. I don't think it was a large one on the number of sheets that were actually not included for sampling. But it would not have had any sort of large impact on the overall validity rate. Okay. So the problems we observed in the 2002 election cycle is that duplicates were sometimes not identified and or not properly reported by the counties. This has been a real bear for the counties is to track these duplicates. And we actually had one case where the counties submitted their initial duplicate reports to us, and then the observers went out and they had been tracking their own work on this and sort of trying to check to make sure that the counties were doing this correctly, and uncovered in one case a couple of duplicates in one petition that the counties had not reported to us. And so what we asked the counties to do was take a look at those sheets again, because the observers brought them to us first, and we said take a look at these. And if they are indeed duplicates, please revise your reports to us. And two counties did do that. They did revise their duplicate reports to us, and this happened after we had already made an initial call on that particular petition saying that it had made the ballot by a whisker. And what happened when these two new duplicates were reported to us was that it put the initiative in the category of not making the ballot by a whisker, and so there was a lot of publicity around that. It was not a fun situation, people were pretty unhappy all through the process, but it is an example of where the observers did succeed in sort of exposing a systemic weakness. The other issue that we tend to wrestle with is the signature verification standards. We've got this process going on in 36 different counties, and the county clerks have done an excellent job of getting training from the state crime lab for their people that do signature verification and trying to do that on a regular basis. But it's pretty hard for anybody, including the Secretary of State's office, to provide an absolute assurance that the standards for matching ballot signatures are consistent from one county to the next, and even from one person to the next in some of the large counties where they're using maybe several people to do that process. So we are dependent on the good work of the clerks, and most of them do an excellent job. Can I turn to you and say that absolutely the same standards were used in every case? I cannot. All we can do is try and do the best we can, but that is an issue that we wrestle with.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
What about the voters who are getting older? They've had a stroke or they have Parkinson's, and their signatures obviously are not the same. There's really no way for your office to know that, correct?
Well, yeah, it's the counties that verify that, and the petition process is a little bit treated a little bit differently than ballots. And for that kind of a voter, if that signature was not a match and it looked like there was some sort of problem with their ability to sign, on a ballot, that voter would get some sort of contact from the county elections office asking them to please come in and explain why the signatures don't match. In the verification process for initiatives, there are too many signatures to verify and too little time. We have to do the entire process within 30 days to contact every voter whose signature doesn't match and ask them why. And so in that kind of case, that signature would just be coded more than likely by the county as a no match.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundbeck, I recall hearing some controversy about some signatures that were challenged, and because they were ruled ineligible, that entire sheets of signatures were thrown out. Is that pertaining to anything that you...
I don't recall that happening. Because of that issue, I was just having debate. I was having with Senator Corcoran. You know, it's an issue of throwing the good out with the bad, and I don't recall a situation where we threw out entire sheets of signatures.
It just happened to have brought to my attention in my county.
Maybe it was on a county initiative or something that we're not. You know, we don't have direct oversight over that. So, are we ready? Yeah. Move on. Okay. Again, the misspelled names by writers are a problem that was observed in the 2002 election cycle, and we had observer challenges again that were led to reversals of some decisions. And at the request of observers, some counties reversed initial decisions regarding the eligibility of some voters. I have to tell you that as I mentioned earlier, that this whole process has to take place within 30 days. And it sort of took on a life of its own. And on the last day that the counties were verifying signatures, some of the atmosphere in a couple of our counties was pretty rugged, with people on both sides of an initiative petition in there pressuring the county clerk to reverse decisions or make different decisions than they had made earlier about specific signatures. And it sort of took on the atmosphere of an election recount in a way. And it's the first time that that's happened in Oregon, and it was something that that the elections officials at the county level clearly struggled with, and there was sort of no precedent that sort of told them what to do in these kinds of situations. But the observers did uncover duplicates that were missed by the counties. They made initial their role made initial initiative qualification for the ballot determinations either inaccurate or uncertain up to the last minute. I finally had to go down and tell the press guys, you know, historically we've issued a press release that said that such and such an initiative made the ballot, you know, and we'd sort of do it in succession over the course of the 30 days. You'd deal with one, it made the ballot, you'd issue a press release. You'd deal with the next two or three, you'd issue another press release. And I finally had to go down and tell them, you know, all these numbers could change. The deadline is really 30 days. We've got observers that work in the process here. And it's a whole new ballgame. It's very different. Those changes in determination, though, did confuse both the public and the press. Led to the general atmosphere of confusion. I'd like to talk to you about some proposed solutions. We'd like to do a process review, and the objective should be to establish clearly defined roles for the Elections Division and the Attorney General's Office, including the methods of investigation and education of the public and chief petitioners and circulators in regards to this process. We think that it would be worth our time and the legislature's time to discuss adding a full-time investigator to supervise signature fraud cases in our office. One of the complaints that we receive from people who file complaints with us is how long it takes to deal with those cases, and we are sympathetic to that complaint. We think it's worth it to discuss a law requiring signers to fill out all the petition information and no longer allow writers to do that job. We think it's time to discuss a law requiring signature gatherers, those who engage in paid signature gathering, to register with our office and to provide a valid signature as a circulator to us so that we have a way, when all those sheets come into us, if we have a question, of determining whether or not the signature on the attestation at the bottom of the sheet matches the signature that this person signed when they registered with us. And it would provide us an opportunity to provide some training to those people. We're going to, by rule, establish some guidelines for signature verification and a signature verification sort of a guidebook for the counties to follow. We'd also like to look at the possibility, and I have asked them to distribute to you, maybe doing something very different in Oregon for paid signature gathering, which is official sequentially numbered petition booklets to be used by paid signature gatherers. Now, these would not be used by folks who gather signatures on a volunteer basis or through the mail, but simply by paid signature gatherers. And you each should have a copy of the booklet. It's got a yellow cover and looks like this. And we think it's worth it to consider doing this kind of booklet for paid signature gathering. It would give the chief petitioners more control over who is circulating a petition on their behalf. One of the complaints we receive right now from chief petitioners is that the current system is sort of wild and woolly in one respect, and that there can be people out there gathering signatures on your behalf, and you don't know who they are, you don't know whether you want them gathering signatures on your behalf. They have a tendency to lose control of the situation. And so these booklets would provide a little bit more control. These would be the way we envision this working is that we would have a contract with a printer. When you get your certified ballot title as a chief petitioner, we would prepare all the information that goes into the booklet for the printer, and then the chief petitioner would call the printer and order the number of books they want. And the cost would be borne by the chief petitioners. One other benefit for the chief petitioner is right now they have to come to us to get their sheets approved, and it's sort of a painful process for a lot of them. They have difficulty doing that and doing it correctly under the law, and so they'll come to us and we'll say, no, not good enough, and you know, they'll come back and there'll maybe be one other thing missing, and they find it a very annoying and tedious process. And I think it's time for us to do that on behalf of the chief petitioners, and this kind of moving to this kind of booklet would allow us to do that. It would also make it more difficult for fraudulent signature gatherers to use stopper petitions and mislead people, because once word got out that an official state petition is in a booklet like this, all people would have to do is look for the booklet to confirm that it is an official state petition. The other thing we think we should investigate is when centralized voter registration is in place, that we should centralize signature verification within the SOS Elections Division. Right now it's being dispersed to all 36 counties. The counties, of course, would love to get rid of the job, and we're not exactly thrilled about accepting it, but it would solve that problem of possible differing standards from one county to the next if we centralize that and have it supervised by one group of people. I wanted to talk to you before I get off the subject just a little bit about Measure 26, which passed. And that's the one that says no payment by the signature. It passed by a healthy margin, as you can tell. It prohibits payment and receipt of payment based on the number of initiative referendum petition signatures obtained. The proponents hope it's going to result in increased validity rates by removing a monetary incentive to gather more signatures, and the practice of paper signatures commonly blamed as a cause for currently the high invalidity rates. And we have seen some historical evidence that those who are not using the paper signature technique historically do result in higher than average validity rates. So these figures down here are the same figures that I showed you earlier. So at this point,
any questions?
That's the completion of the presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask you, John, on your yellow draft here, any person who knowingly signs their name on an initiative or referendum petition more than one time, violation of the law, Class C felony, typically when you have these petitions, you have a lot of senior citizens that sign. They're not clear whether they've signed before. How do you determine if they've done it knowingly? And have you had any cases where you've actually convicted people of a Class C felony?
I'm not aware of a case where you've actually convicted someone of a Class C felony. In fact, this year, because the duplicate problem appeared to be increasing, for the first time our division sent everyone who showed up as a duplicate in this process a letter saying, you know, it's against the law to sign a petition more than once. For now, we're going to presume that you did not know that, but we'll be keeping your name and the fact that you received this letter on file in the Elections Division, and then in future years, we'll be able to see if these same people crop up again. In answer to your first question about how do people remember, I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, I think it's a common problem that people forget. It's a problem because these petitions, some of them are out on the street for so long, sometimes more than a year. And sometimes it's people just not paying attention, and they just want to get rid of that pesky signature gatherer. But sometimes it's truly a case of somebody just forgot. And so that's why the word knowingly is in there. We would have to determine that they did it on purpose in order to convict them of anything.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes. Commissioner Clarno.
What are you going to be charging petitioners for this?
Well, I don't have a good answer for that for you today, Senator Clarion, because that would depend on the contract we're able to sign with the printer. We envision going out for a competitive contract to get the price down as low as we possibly can. The chief petitioners now are incurring expenses because they're already paying to do copies of their petitions. I think the question would be, are we going to substantially raise costs for copying petitions over what they are now? I don't have a good answer for you today, but I think it would be minimal. That would be my guess.
Any other questions, Mr. Lindberg? Okay. Thank you, John. Appreciate your presentation. Now call Phil Tradel, Special Counsel to the Attorney General.
Chair Doyle, Chair Clarno, Chair Brown, members of the committee, I very much appreciate the invitation to come speak to you today. I briefly want to just apprise you of the Attorney General's role in both ballot title matters and then initiative review. For the record, I'm Philip Tradel. I'm Special Counsel to the Attorney General. I'd like to start first with initiative review because that's kind of how our office gets involved in things actually at the very front end. During the last couple of election cycles, there have been approximately 185 or more initiative proposals. Each one of those proposals carries with it an obligation on the part of the Secretary of State to determine whether it is something that can be actually approved for signature gathering and then appropriately appear on the ballot. With respect to statutory proposals, that involves a review under the constitutional requirements for single subject and for full text. Those kinds of challenges we haven't seen too many of in the past, and certainly not too many that have been upheld to the extent that they've led to the invalidity of a proposal. The full text requirement imposes a requirement that the actual text of the measure be set out, the text of the statute that's going to be adopted, or if a constitutional adoption, a constitutional amendment. Single subject requirement requires that the scope of that proposed measure be within the confines of a single subject. But that has been very, very loosely interpreted by the appellate courts, and we've only had one case to date that has struck down a measure on single subject grounds. And that was one that dealt with, I think it was West Side Light Rail and cormorant protection over on the coast and a number of other things. That's the only example in the history that has struck down something on single subject. On the other side of things, there are constitutional proposals, and they have four tests that they must meet to be able to be approved for signature gathering and to go on the ballot. They have the same full text requirement, the same single subject requirement. They also have to meet a test called the separate vote or separate amendment test. And then they also have to be, if they're an initiative proposal, they must constitute an amendment and not a revision of the Constitution. We've had no cases that have developed under the revision versus amendment, although those kinds of claims get raised sometimes. The biggest area that we've seen develop in the last number of years has been on the separate vote, separate amendment question. About 4 years ago or so, the Supreme Court issued a case in Armada versus Kitzhaber and struck down a measure on separate vote, separate amendment grounds. That kind of heightened our awareness that we need to be providing advice at the start to the Secretary of State on those four constitutional issues when we see constitutional amendments proposed. The court has opined that the Secretary of State has an obligation to ensure that measures, before they are allowed out to gather signatures, meet those constitutional procedural requirements. So our office, the Department of Justice, we formulated a committee that reviews those measures under those statutory and constitutional, for both constitutional and statutory proposals. Now, that means that we have to review, you know, the 185 measures that come in. So we do provide that kind of advice to the Secretary of State at the outset with respect to all of the proposals that then ultimately lead into the ballot title process. I just wanted to mention that because I'm not sure that you know, you members of the legislature would necessarily be aware that we're engaged from the very beginning at that level. Those kinds of decisions have some fallouts because the Secretary of State actually issues an order that either a measure meets constitutional requirements or it doesn't. Well, if it meets constitutional requirements, then it is approved to gather signatures. That doesn't necessarily mean that issue is forever dead and gone. Somebody certainly can litigate the validity of the Secretary of State's determination, and if they want to do so pre-election, they need to do so within 60 days of the date of the Secretary of State's determination. But there also is an open question there about whether, you know, clear down the line after the election has occurred, whether those same constitutional procedural requirements can be raised and litigated again. In fact, Armada was a post-election separate amendment case. After the election, after approval of the voters, the Supreme Court was faced with a separate vote question on that matter and struck down the measure. There are some policy decisions out there that I think the legislature and members of the Legislative Assembly need to just keep in mind when you're considering ideas that might come up about those kinds of issues. There has been talk in years past of forcing all challenges on those kinds of constitutional procedural requirements to occur at the time the Secretary of State makes that determination. There are some difficulties. There are some good things about that, and there are some bad things about that. The good things about that are it avoids the circumstance where you've gone through a costly, lengthy process of signature gathering, qualification for the ballot, getting it voted on. Conduct of an election is not a cheap thing, nor an easy thing. And I think there's something that's difficult about overturning something that has been approved by the voters. The costs of making that challenge up front be exclusive is that most likely you will see, now I wouldn't say 185, but you will see a much greater number of those kinds of claims litigated at the front end. And that kind of segues into some of my discussion about the ballot title process. But out of those, on average, 185 or so measures that were filed during the last two election cycles, in the 2000 election cycle, 18 of those qualified to be on the ballot. And in the 2002 election cycle, 7, I believe, qualified to be on the ballot. So to the extent that you would push litigation up front on those constitutional procedural requirements, you may be litigating, you know, however many cases there might be, of matters that never would have appeared on the ballot. So that is just kind of, those are some policy calls that take in different directions with respect to how you would want to approach those kinds of issues. It certainly wouldn't matter in the terms of our office's advice to the Secretary of State at the beginning. Where it would come into play for our office is, obviously, if there were many more claims raised and many more cases brought, that litigation costs for our office and representing Secretary of State would certainly go up. But those constitutional and, you know, kind of approval for signature gathering issues aside, then our office is also currently under the statutory scheme charged with the ballot title process and drafting ballot titles. I'm going to quote Senator Minnis on one part, that there's no constitutional requirement for a ballot title. I think there are good policy reasons for having ballot titles, and I think there are good policy reasons for having somebody, an independent body, Attorney General's office certainly qualifies as that, there are others, to draft ballot titles, because it is one objective piece of information for the voters to consider. I think you had, at least on the House side, you had a couple of matters come up today about explanatory statements. And the Explanatory Statement Committee right now, by statute, or I think it's by statute, is created by two proponents, two opponents, and a choice of the Secretary of State's office. That serves to provide some balance in that process, but what we have seen over the years with the ballot title process is that some of these measures are extremely complex, and quite typically we utilize a number of the legal resources in our office to attempt to come up with an accurate and hopefully fair and impartial statement of what the proposed measure constitutes. I'll very quickly walk you through the ballot title process so you'll just know how that process works. Once the proposed measure is filed with the Secretary of State's office, and it only takes 25 signatures to file it with the Secretary of State's office, then they turn around and deliver that proposed measure to our office for the drafting of a ballot title. And we have, under current statute, 10 business days to draft a ballot title. We file that draft ballot title back with the Secretary of State. Secretary of State publishes that for comments. There's a 10-day period for comments to be filed. And any person can comment on our ballot title, the chief proponents, the chief petitioners, as well as any other elector in the state. And once those comments are received by the Secretary of State's office, then the comments are submitted back to our office, and we have another 10-day window period of time to draft a certified ballot title. And we have historically, in filing that certified ballot title, both not only taken into account the comments that were filed, but draft a letter in attempting to explain why we understood some of those comments to have merit, understood some of the other comments not to have merit, kind of given explanations to why we made the changes to the ballot title that we did and why we didn't make the changes to the ballot title that we didn't. The hope there is that by giving that kind of an explanation, that it helps the process in the sense that people both understand our thinking and then also have a chance to evaluate whether they want to take the next step, which would be to challenge that ballot title in the Supreme Court. And currently, as I think you heard this morning in your hearing, that those challenges are brought directly in the Supreme Court, and we appear to defend our ballot titles. There are some questions along the way that I'd like to just very briefly touch on there, too. Over the years, there have been proposals to have somebody other than our office draft ballot titles. We don't have a vested interest in having the ballot title work. I've done it for years. I find it kind of fascinating in some ways, and there's some satisfaction, but it truly is a case where everybody hates what you do, and so everybody is picking at you, and it's not the most fun in the world. On the other hand, I think policy-wise, it really does serve the public interest to have some independent entity with legal expertise draft ballot titles. The complexity of these measures is all over the place. It covers everything from mobile home and floating home rental limitations to proposals to impose a sales tax, do away with property tax, to workers' comp. I mean, it touches upon everything. So our office has, over the years, built up some expertise in the sense of we have been doing this for a while. We also do have, through the 200 attorneys that are associated with the Attorney General's office, colleagues that we can turn to talk about difficult issues that come up, and we do that on a collegial basis. There certainly are costs associated with having our office do it. We bill it to an unbillable number so that it puts into our budget, but no direct entity gets billed for our ballot title work, which I think is indicative of part of the reason why we don't. It's not a matter that we have an ownership interest in. I think it's probably at least one of the best repositories for that work currently. We have seen. There are a couple other dynamics at work that I'd like to touch upon as well. Currently, it is very easy to trigger the ballot title process. It requires 25 signatures and a filing of a proposed measure with the Secretary of State's office. At that point, then, the ballot title process kicks in. And there are costs associated with that ballot title process. There's the time and expense of our office in drafting ballot titles. There's the time and expense if people take them to challenge before the Oregon Supreme Court. And that mechanism is not the only mechanism that I think needs to exist, because the ballot titles end up, I think, being a marketable entity. What the testimony that we heard last legislative session was that the ballot title becomes a very important piece of things. Currently, there's no cost associated with getting a ballot title. You could file a measure today and get a ballot title. You could turn around tomorrow and file a different measure, change one word, and get a different, you know, another measure going, which would generate the need for drafting the ballot title with respect to that measure as well. There's some concern under the current system that people do a couple of different things. One is file a number of measures on the same subject, attempting to get a different ballot title. There's also concern that people litigate ballot titles simply to hold up the process. And some of those concerns, I think, could be addressed through various kinds of proposals that would touch upon the ballot title system. We, in fact, have a proposal that we are submitting this legislative session to require that 10% of the signatures be gathered under a final measure summary, and then the ballot title process be triggered. That's only one approach. We think that has some merit to be considered. With that, I think I'll kind of step back and ask, if there are any questions.
Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Phil, I guess I have a couple of questions. One is, how do other states with the initiative system do their ballot title process, and have you looked at any of those? And
Chair Doyle, Senator Brown, at one point in time, some time ago, I saw some material and just generic kind of survey form about who is responsible for drafting the ballot titles and things. My recollection is it's done differently around the states, that there are some states that have the Attorney General's office do it. There are some states that have an entity like legal counsel do it. There are some states that have something along the lines of an explanatory committee process in place. I think there are a variety of approaches.
Okay. Madam Chair. Thanks. And then in talking about the ballot titles, do you have a sense, I don't know if you're directly involved in writing all of them or whatever, but do you have a sense of how many ballot titles are actually filed and how many are actually used? Is it 20%? Is it 60%?
Chair Clarno, Senator Brown. During the 2002 election cycle, there were 183 measures that were filed. So there were 183 ballot titles that were drafted. Out of those, there were only 11 of those that signatures were actually turned in to be counted. And there were 43 of those that were approved by the Secretary of State to circulate. And that's kind of an intriguing comparison between the 183 and the 43, because the 183 measures, like I say, trigger a ballot title process that has gone through. After the certified ballot title is issued, and either our certified ballot title stands or somebody is challenged in the Supreme Court and ultimately our title is certified, that doesn't automatically translate into on-the-street signature gathering. They need to go back and file the appropriate forms with the Secretary of State and actually get approved to go out and gather signatures. So something occurred for 140 of those proposals that led them not to be out on the street gathering signatures. That could be that either the persons in the meantime had lost interest in pursuing the measure, the ballot title didn't seem satisfactory to them, so they just stopped the process and didn't gather signatures under that ballot title, or some other motivation. Maybe time had passed and they didn't believe there was enough time left to gather the signatures.
When you talked about the Attorney General's office absorbs the cost, I assume it's general fund. Do you have a rough estimate of what it costs?
Chair Clarno, Senator Brown, I'm trying to recall. I believe that two legislative sessions ago, we submitted information to the legislature, and I think it was through the Ways and Means Committee as part of our budget presentation, that I'm going to probably misspeak here, that it either was $200,000 per biennium or else it was $200,000 annually.
Okay.
I do recall that on average our office expends about 15 hours of attorney time per measure, and that includes ones that only have a ballot title drafted and includes ones that are pursued all the way through the Supreme Court. So on average, we expend about 15 hours of attorney time.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is, how do I get more than one ballot title for a measure so that I can see which one is going to be the most effective in getting past the public?
Chair Clarno, Representative Berger. Currently, you would need to submit one measure under 25 signatures with the Secretary of State and a second measure with 25 signatures to the Secretary of State. That filing with the Secretary of State would trigger the ballot title process. Now, I have to caution you that our office is charged with drafting a accurate, fair, impartial ballot title. If the two measures that you submitted to the Secretary of State are virtually identical, you will obtain from our office very similar, if not virtually identical, ballot titles, because we will have determined that this is the ballot title that, in our estimation, fairly, accurately, impartially describes the measure. So if your question is, how do you get different ballot titles, then you would need to submit measures to the Secretary of State that had differences in them. And that would trigger our office to use different terms to describe the differences in those measures.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Does the difference have to be significant, or can it be somewhat of a minor difference?
Chair Clonar, Representative Verger. To the extent that the changes are minor, that would correspondingly lead to less variation between the ballot titles. There is, by statute, a requirement that, and it's phrased in approximately this language, to avoid confusion, similar ballot titles should not be used for separate measures, something along those lines. The difficulty that we have seen historically, and I personally was involved in this case, and I don't believe that there was any ill will involved on any of the participants' parts, but there were five kind of serially filed measures that, and it was a very complex proposal that had to do with capping individual income tax rates and affecting business income and excise tax rates, and then had differences in how revenue under those schemes would be distributed. Mm-hmm. The framework for a ballot title is, by statute, it has a 15-word caption, two 25-word yes result statement and no result statements, and 125-word summary. Well, in order to capture the essence of those measures in the caption, those captions on all five of those measures remain the same. In fact, the yes statement and the no statement stayed the same, and it was only differences in the summary that accommodated, in that respect, what were minor differences between those measures in the overall scheme of things. Those ballot titles were ultimately certified by the Supreme Court and approved, the ones that our office had drafted. Other circumstances could lead to different results if the changes were more significant.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just to follow up on that, if a person wanted to say they wanted to reduce property taxes, if they presented measures to say reduce property tax and replace it with a sales tax, or reduce property tax and compensate by making cuts in other programs, or in other words have different systems for reducing property taxes, then in those cases you get very different types of ballot titles. Is that correct?
Chair Clarno, Senator Burdick, yes. From the description that you've given, I would think that they might well on the caption start with, limits property taxes, and then the other effect that it might have, like replaces it with sales tax or replaces it with income tax increase. Or
right. So you could get someone who had a goal, a policy goal, and they could take a number of different approaches and see which one got the most desirable ballot title.
Chair Clarno, Senator Burdick, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
You may have addressed this earlier, but are you charged statutorily to do these?
Chair Clarno, yes. By statute, the responsibility falls to us to draft the ballot title.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Nothing further to come before the committee? Sure. Thank you. And this is nice to share this meeting with the House. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It worked out really well, at least for us. Did it work out well for you? Good.